Bob, let's start with your question.
Yeah, when I was supposed to be meditating, I spent a good deal of time thinking about this. Anyway, so I thought of an analogy. Suppose that I was dying and there was a group of men who were invested in finding a new meaning. And I don't have a favorite bell or rosary, but I like books. So I really like Joseph Conrad for a long time, like over 30 years. I don't much care for Joseph Conrad anymore. So I'm imagining here these guys. Now the bottom line is they're going to find a new me.
Yeah.
It's not like they can say, well, we couldn't decide. They're going. They have an agenda, which is to find a new me. So they put out Lord Jim. Well, so the child picks Lord Jim. So, you know, which me is it that he's picking?
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly.
The one that I'm identifying with now, or, you know, this guy I was for all those years. And what the people who are making the decision is, yeah, I mistrust the idea of an objective decision. So my feeling is that the deciders are bringing themselves to this. They have to make a decision, and part of it, the decision is not just an observer looking at stuff. The observer is part of the decision. So that's kind of where, you know, the talk is, you know, what. It's more about explanations, you know, what constitutes an explanation. And it's a lot easier to discredit one than to prove it. So
yes,
I think the amazing Randy's idea would be, you know, it's a lot easier to attack something than it is to definitely prove it. So, I could think of a lot of reasons to say, well, you know, this is why the kid picked the right book. But it's not like... It seems like the problem tends to get oversimplified because, you know, if you pick a couple of parameters, or if the kid only has to choose between a bell and a rosary, what if you give them five or six choices? And the people who are deciding have to put this into a small enough context so that they can make a decision. So, you know, it's like a can of worms. So.
Exactly. It is a big can of worms, which is why... these things, first of all, they haven't really ever invited anybody to investigate them, you know. And if you see it in a movie, well, I mean...
Here's proof.
Proof, right. Yeah, and so these things are complicated. Explanations are complicated. And we should keep in mind, you know, as Shakespeare said, there is more in heaven and earth, Horatio, than is spoken of in your philosophy. And when we speak of emptiness, if we understand what this term emptiness is referring to, it's referring to the limits of our ability to know anything other than what our mind allows us to know. You know, and this is the problem with all metaphysics, you know, and always will be. Whatever metaphysics, basically all metaphysical explanations of the way things are empty. Another way of saying that is they are all wrong. They're all incorrect. You know, they know more correct than a frog or a mouse has an idea of the way the world is. And we would, if we could somehow participate in that idea, we'd say, "Oh, how totally foolish!" You know, but the idea that our view of reality is any closer to the way things really are than the frogs or the mouse is just pure pride, hubris, and foolishness. is unrealistic. But when we try to explain things, I suppose you'd have to say that that's where science came from. Recognizing how difficult it is to explain things. And so science focuses on all the easy things and explains them, you know, and leaves aside the more difficult ones for very good reason. But explanations. What's really important, though, is to look at what's going on in your mind when you're confronted by something like that and you're looking for an explanation. I mentioned to you that, you know, since we're talking about reincarnation, the work that was done by, I believe I got his first name right, Ian. I know his last name is Stevenson. But he made a career of collecting and investigating stories of children who claimed to remember previous lives. And he and his assistants collected thousands of these accounts and then tried to very rigorously screen them for those which could be for possible contamination, right? Kids basically being fed this information or picking it up somewhere else and so on and so forth. And there's a number of very interesting things that came out of this life work. One is that it's an extremely rare phenomenon, whatever you want to make of it, exceedingly rare, considering the population of the world. The frequency with which children claim to have memories of another life is extremely uncommon. Then, the next thing that's very interesting is that after they very meticulously tried to rule out all sources of contamination of the account, they were left with a really rather sizable number of accounts of children that seemed to have knowledge of what had happened, of things pertaining to individuals who died before they were born. And to say that they had meticulously ruled out all sources of contamination means you're left with an account that you really don't have an explanation for. So that's very, very interesting. The kinds of things is, you know, a child would keep claiming, well, you know, I used to live in this town over there, and my parents' name was such and such, you know. And one way or another, if parents finally gave in and drove over to that town, and the child said, that's it, that's the house where I used to live, you know, and identify the family, these are my parents, and be able to tell certain things about the events in the person's life, or sometimes about how they died. Quite amazing, would you agree? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Definitely food for thought. Now, one thing about this, for the children that this happened with, they would usually have these memories very early in life, and they would disappear completely by the time they're 5 or 6 years old. Mm-hmm. Completely. Mm-hmm. Not a left, nothing. Very typical, and that was the average age. Some sooner, some a little bit later, but, you know, these memories or this knowledge would fade, and there's nothing left after that. Also very interesting. Yes?
Do you have an idea of how many children they found that had an experience like this that couldn't be explained?
Well, they had, this was over a period, I think, of 30 years, and there were eventually a number of people working with them, and in many different countries in the world. United States, India, China, you know, Sri Lanka, Burma. They found a hugely disproportionate frequency in countries where the culture believed in reincarnation compared to there's an interesting thing right there. What else can I tell you about this? There are also, well, I can say that. They sorted them according to how purely inexplicable the situations were. And from all these years' work, I think that they did end up with, out of thousands and thousands of cases, something of the order of 30 or maybe 50 that, you know, there was really, they were certain that there was no way that there was any contamination could come into this. But many more that they graded at sort of various degrees, including a lot that, you know, were very, very suspicious that there are many sources of other ways the child could come up with this information. But still, quite a few cases that they felt, and of course, as you can imagine, this was not received without many, many challenges, you know, and skepticism. But they did end up with a number of cases, at least a few tens of cases, that it's pretty difficult for the most dedicated skeptic or cynic to come up with other explanations for it. And so that's really the mystery to deal with. Now, what I found very interesting reading this is that the only thing really that these children had in common with people whose memories they had or whose life they had knowledge about was the memories. Their personalities were totally different. You know? In other words, there was no evidence that anybody could point to and say, wow, that's the same person. And that's exactly what I'm talking about with the experience that I have. And, you know, is that it's like seeing a movie or reading a book or whatever, where you get the information and you can relate to it and identify with it. But when you read a book, even when you really get into the character, you're not that fictional person. Mm-hmm. Or maybe even it's a biography or a historical book. You're not that person, right? And there's no question in your mind that the idea of me, myself, who I am, never gets confused with the character in the book you read. Or movie, no matter how you identify with the character in the movie. Like, sometimes you really do feel like them. It's kind of high, you know. I used to watch Clint Eastwood movies and I go out feeling like Clint Eastwood. I knew I wasn't Clint Eastwood.
You made a comment just really quick about experience that you had. I left last week. Mm-hmm. I didn't stay for the talk. Can you just, was that something that was discussed last week?
What I was referring to is I had some spontaneously arising, what you might call memories, that didn't have anything to do with my life and that were quite specific. And then because I took an interest in these things, and then I experimented with that and recovered more of those memories and others. I call them memories. They're not really memories. It's sort of little tiny snatches of visions of a place and circumstance. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're like little bits of memories, but they're very isolated and without a lot of continuity. But with enough of them, you sort of piece together a picture of a place and of people and a person as experiencer.
Is there an emotional content to these?
I would say only secondarily, the same way you would if you were watching a movie or reading a book. Mm-hmm.
There's got feedback coming from your microphone.
Feedback? Oh.
Yeah. So.
But I did come to a very similar conclusion as to what I was speaking about with the children studied by Dr. Stevenson, is that I wasn't the person that, I mean, the person who I was very different mm-hmm. in all of the kinds of ways that we would identify ourselves. You know, if somebody said, well, who are you? Tell me who you are. And you'd say, well, you know, and you've probably all had occasion to think these thoughts or do something like this, right? You know. And at that level, you know, certainly I wasn't this person. And I think in terms of watching these children grow up, these researchers agree that, well, you know, they didn't act like the what was known or what could be known about the people that they had this knowledge about. Yeah.
When I hear you talking about that, it seems like, of course, they're not acting the same way that they were, because that was a different lifetime. Mm-hmm. And this is another lifetime, so of course they would be different people. Why have the same lifetime twice? But like that. So are you saying that you? Where are you saying that the memories that you had came from?
Where am I saying
that? Yeah, where are you saying that they came from?
Well, I'm speculating.
Yeah.
That they came from other people that lived at other times.
And just because you were.
And your question is, well, then, how did I get them? Well,
yes.
That's and that is the question. That is the mystery here. The same thing with these children we're talking about. Why is it? What is it about their mind that can tune in on these memories? Because you know, let me just remind you, lest you forget, that what we know about the brain is that. Memories are stored as functions within the brain that are dependent upon specific structures. And, you know, Wilder Penfield took the top off people's heads and stimulated different parts of their brain, and their memories of past events would come back crystal clear. And, of course, if certain areas of the brain are damaged or removed, those memories are gone forever. So, we have a further mystery here. You know, obviously this child's brain is not the same brain that stored those memories in the first place. So how on earth does this completely separate brain that stores its own memories in terms of the structure and function of that brain tune in on things that were stored in another brain that's now turned into worm food, right? Or ashes, or something. That's a very, very deep mystery, you know. And it asks the same thing about anybody who does any sort of past life review practice that comes up with something, has those same questions to ask. Well, what is this all about? What is going on? No. And my answer is, I don't know. And as I said before, from Shakespeare, there is more in heaven and earth, Horatio, and is spoken of in your philosophy. Emptiness means that whatever is so far beyond the capacity, the limited capacity of our mind to organize and interpret it, that to say that, well, I know enough about reality that I should be able to figure out absolutely everything and provide a really solid, unassailable explanation. You know, there are things that are going to be beyond explanation. I don't know. But back to your question, what do I think? What is my surmise? What is my own interpretation? Is that at the level of what we call mind, and remember what we're calling mind is not, it's empty too. It's not the way we think of it. But there's no, absolutely no good reason to think that just because I walk around feeling like my mind is mine and it's separate from the entire world and it only exists in time, in terms of this isolated experience, there's no reason to think that that's true. I mean, we filled up museums with the bones that we dug up of animals that died millions and millions of years ago, and we find footprints in the sand of where somebody walked yesterday, and everything in between. So everything leaves its imprint. Why should it be different in that segment of reality that our limited mental capacity designates as mine and experiences in such an isolated way? So a simple answer, I would say, those kids, for reasons that we don't necessarily know, their brains tuned in to this. And that people who do past life review practices can't tune in on things. Why would some person's brain be able to tune in on these sorts of things? Well, maybe one of the reasons is that the similarities of that, let's stop calling it brain, the mind, similarities of that mind to the mind that they're tuning in on. And so this is not something that is too far afield from what the Buddha said. He said that every thought and word and action produces its results. And you are not reincarnated, but the results of your actions manifest in the future. It is the karmic imprints that are reborn in the sense that they arise in another being in the future. And so that's what I would say that is. Okay? That to some degree or another. But here's another really important thing. Why do we concern ourselves with these things? And of course, we're very attached to the self that we think we are. That's why. And we love the idea that the self that we think we are can continue on after the death of the body. But if we look at these cultures in the world that have always believed in reincarnation, the problem that they've confronted is that, or let me put it this way, if you think about it enough, the things that I've talked to you about, to realize that it is this feeling that you are this separate self that has been the cause of so much of the suffering in your life, and the cause of so many of the things that you've said and done that you wish you hadn't, and that have impacted negatively on other people, that if indeed there is such a self that continues on and on and on, the problem is only worse than ever. Right? And at the time of the Buddha, the spiritual movement of the time, which continues today in certain religious traditions, was to achieve the point where this self no longer continued, because it became dissolved into Brahma. It dissolved into the ultimate source of being. and came to it. There was the end of this separate self, the separate suffering and pain inflicting self. So that was the goal. It wasn't seized upon as, oh, this is wonderful, it means I won't die. It's like, oh, this is a real problem. And the Buddha came along and he said, look, your problem isn't what's going to happen in the next life. Your problem is what's happening right now in this life. So quit worrying about the little self dissolving into Brahman in the next life. Let's do it right now. Let's get away from this separate self. This separate self. Is it real? Is this a real problem? Are we doing the right thing? You know, worrying about this separate self and its continuity and and the answer he came up with was, wow, this is a mistake from the beginning. The people that are worried about their precious self dying when they die, you know, at the end of their life, you know, it's not going to happen because that self that they're worried about doesn't exist anyway. What's going to die is the body and the mind that they're attached to. And for those that are worried about their self being reborn over and over again in the endless turning of the wheel of samsara, and that's what the word samsara means, is the wheel of birth and re-death. And this is the way it's put, rebirth and re-death. You know. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're missing the boat too, because there's no self that's going that process. Mm-hmm. And that indeed, if you look at your life and what's happening and what the problem is, and as we started going through this, if you understand the nature of suffering and you look to realize that suffering comes from craving and attachment, and that if you could only be free of craving and attachment, you'd be free of suffering. And then you look to the next strata below that, say, where is all this, what is all this craving and attachment about? Well, it's about this separate self that I feel that I am, that is basically in this hopeless struggle with a much larger reality that's never going to cooperate with the needs of this self. And that's the thing. The self, you know, the self that the Buddha was talking about, the one that is so embedded in our minds, in our psyches, that doesn't exist. This is the self that we think is the experiencer of things and the doer of things, that is one single, permanent, and separate entity. And it's not even the singleness that's the problem, because we can say, okay, it's not just one, it's made up of a lot of parts. But don't tell me that it's a bunch of different selves, I don't like that. But at least myself can be made up of parts. And that's not a problem, okay? But when we look inside, we don't find any one thing. We don't find any single self. We don't find any self that is permanent. Well, everything we find is constantly changing. As a matter of fact, everything everywhere is constantly changing. It's impermanent. It's process. Some processes are slower, some more rapidly, but everything is only process. And our minds try to compensate with that through attachment. Since everything is impermanent, the minds keep trying to hold on to things, the things that we want. And one of the things it holds on to is this idea of being a constant self. Even that, you know, when I was talking to you, and one of these days we'll get back to the topic of soul creation, you know, since you don't really have the kind of self you think you do, you can work with what you have and create something really good out of it. You know. And in that process, we can unify something that consists of many parts. And we can create a kind of stability and consistency in the evolving processes that make us up. and we don't need to worry about permanent versus constantly changing. But the one thing that's always going to be a problem is this separate. This is really the root of it, the feeling of separate. A separate self, a separate I, separate me. Separate from what? Well, separate from everything else. Well, I've lost the battle before I began. Mm-hmm. You know, the physicist Richard Feynman, describing the situation of human beings in this world, said, you can't win. You can't win and you can't get out of the game. you can't win and you can't get out of the game. You know, and that is the problem when you regard yourself in that way, as being a separate self. What's the opposite of that? Hey, doesn't it sound kind of like this merging with the source of everything, Brahman?
Yeah.
It does kind of. Well, the Buddha called it suchness. What is? Jonathan Livingston Seagull called it isness. The Buddha called it suchness. But it's what is. Later Buddhists called it emptiness. They called it dharmakaya, you know, the mind of the enlightenment. They called it Buddha nature. These are all talking about the same thing, called it nirvana. When you stop being a separate self, then everything changes and everything gets a lot better. And that's where we want to get to. But to attach to the idea, attach to the question, the way the Buddha presented it, you know, he said, there's some questions that are a total waste of time and you shouldn't bother yourself with. And one of those is, do I exist or not exist after death? And that's really what these things come down to when you start trying to solve the mystery of reincarnation. Do I exist or do I not exist after death? And that's a waste of time. On the one hand, considering the emptiness of things, our limited capacity, there may be some sense in which we do that we are not going to be able to comprehend. As a matter of fact, I think there is. But it's not as a separate self. There is no separate self. But we can trick ourselves in all kinds of ways. We can say, well, it's not a self, but it's a stream of consciousness. Sounds really good. We can talk all about that. Still, it's separate. I got my stream of consciousness, you got your stream of consciousness. I'll take care of mine, you take care of yours. Okay? And all the same problems are there. Anything we do that ends up giving us a view where we are separate has just landed us right back in the same place we started. We haven't made any progress at all.
If there's a natural fear of death, and so people tend to gravitate toward believing that somehow true death doesn't really need to occur to them, then I would think the danger of that is building a story around that, and that becoming part of the framework of the illusion.
Yes, that's exactly what happens.
As I more and more grasp deeply that I'm not a separate self, do you think that it's almost automatic that you relate to other people differently?
Absolutely. It is completely automatic. I mean, just think about this a little bit. I believe in a self, so I'm filled with craving and grasping. What happens if I don't believe I'm a separate self? Well, instead, where there was desire, now there is loving kindness. There is wish to see the happiness of other beings manifested. Where there was aversion, there is now compassion for the suffering of others. And just as in my previous deluded point of view, I could only see my way to do whatever I could to end my own pain, now, out of my compassion, I'm willing to do whatever I can to relieve the pain of us all. You see, it's not that you lose what you are, I'm still these five aggregates. I'm still this mind and body. But now I'm not putting it in some special relationship. It's all of these minds and bodies. The compassion that I feel for this one and the rest of them is the same. And what I'm willing to do to help us all comes from the same place. Mm-hmm. So as you cease to come from that self-centered place, everything starts to change dramatically. There's something... The pleasure that we experience when some enjoyable event occurs, you know, something tastes good, something feels good, whatever, in terms of this body. Now, when we're relieved of our isolation to ourself, instead of feeling jealous when you feel good, or you know, how come you and not me, it's not fair, or, well, I want some too, and things like that. Instead, it's like, oh, it makes me feel so good that you're enjoying that, you know. So you have a huge new source of joy and happiness in your life. Right? So it changes things in all of those kinds of... That's what they say that when... That the nature of a Buddha is one of true compassion. You know, a kind of compassion that we only have tastes of, but we should cultivate, and we should make sure that whenever we have those tastes, that we get into that place as fully as we possibly can. Because that is our Buddha nature, you know. Our Buddha nature, this knowledge, this wisdom is already here. It's covered over by this delusion. But every now and then the Buddha nature shines through, and the more often that we work towards that happening, then you know, the better our life is going to be. So we, as someone else once put it, we keep cleaning the crystal, you know. So let that Buddha nature shine through. Get all the mud and dirt and crud off of it. And the worst part of the mud and dirt and crud is the attachment to the view of our sacred selfness, our separateness. So that's the suggestion that the Buddha had for the solving this problem that works. And the thing is, though, it's really true. When you do look to see, am I the self I think that I am? What you will find, what everyone that's ever looked, as far as I know, has found the same thing, is that, nope, ain't nobody home. There's just these feelings and perceptions and mental formations and conditioning and consciousness, but nope, there's no little guy in charge up here running things and suffering at the mercy of everything that the universe has to offer. That's not there. And now, very interesting, in the last few decades, people doing cognitive sciences, neurosciences, consciousness studies, philosophers penetratingly investigating these things, they're all coming to the same conclusion. The self is something that the brain makes up. And it even seems that there's probably a specific part of the brain that's its job is to create this idea of self. And somebody mentioned to me the book Stroke of Insight, and the woman, what's her name? I can't remember.
Jill Bolte Taylor.
Yeah, Jill Bolte
Taylor.
Jill Bolte Taylor, yeah. And she had a stroke which, at least for a while, knocked out the part of her brain that made her feel like a separate self.
Yeah.
And she described that experience as nirvana.
Yeah. So. She really had to struggle to make herself recover.
She had to struggle
to
make
herself recover. Yeah.
And the interesting thing that she did as she was recovering, she had an absolutely remarkable recovery from the degree of brain damage that she had. But in the process of her recovery, as she describes it, the way she was, this nirvana-like state that she was in, was absolutely wonderful. But she needed to recover these other mental abilities. And as they started coming back, she carefully sorted them out. And whenever she identified the ones that were the cause of her problems and unhappiness, she said, nope, don't need that one.
Exactly.
Ramdas do something similar after he had the stroke?
What's that?
Ramdas did something similar things when he had the stroke, and he didn't want to go back to his former life,
yes.
in quotes, and accepting it. But I do have a question in context. I wonder what, how you would describe the case of a multiple personality. Is this just parts of different imprints this person receives and cannot create a functioning self to integrate it?
Which kind of person?
A multiple personality.
Well, I don't know a lot about this. The impression I have that might be mistaken is that people don't come into this world with multiple personalities. That events happen in the course of their life that in order to cope with the events, their brain, their mind, partitions itself off so that a large part of who they are gets set aside and they form a new personality which has just those characteristics that are best able to cope with a difficult situation. And so this fracturing of the personality creates, in a sense, I believe that we're all multiple personalities. It's just that the cracks don't show as much.
We're multifaceted.
I think the person who is diagnosed and treated as a multiple personality, where the personalities are in conflict with each other or sometimes don't even know about each other, they're just like us, except the different parts are pulled so far apart there's a big gap in between instead of, you know, just a little crack showing. But it serves a purpose.
Oh, it serves a tremendous purpose.
If you think about it, I think you'll all find that you have multiple personalities. There's the person you're with your mother or your parents. There's the person you're with at work. There's a person on all these different... And you do exactly the same thing multiple personality does. You partition off, and the personality in this given situation includes these characteristics, these mental processes, these parts of you. And the rest of them are set aside. They go into storage, or they stay in the back room and keep the door shut until, you know, you come into a different situation. And we become especially aware of this on those occasions when we find ourselves with this person that we always relate to with personality A, and this person that we always relate to with personality Z, and who am I? It's difficult and embarrassing. One of the things that does happen as a result of this practice, as you come to know your mind, is a kind of integration that takes place. You come to be more and more an integrated person, which isn't that you don't... that you still don't modify your behavior and your attitudes and things like this to according to different situations. But there is just much, much more integrity to the process. You don't do and say things in one situation as one personality that are in conflict with and inconsistent with the overall beliefs and values that your totality holds. This is a unification of mind. This is that part of soul creation where we take our multi-part self and we bring all of the parts into harmony, into cohesion, where, you know, where we're not in opposition to ourselves.
And that's a result also of the practice of meditation, right?
That's right.
Because I'm being able to see some You're, of that yes. happening already.
Yes, I mean, wonderful.
To a small degree, but I can see some of that.
That's right. Yes, that's what happens in meditation. You see the fractures that are there. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is that the process of meditation will start to realign the different parts so that they're now no longer out of harmony with each other. And sometimes you'll be equally surprised at seeing the fractures, to see, wow, these parts of myself that were disparate, different before, are not so on. There's an inner resolution that's taking place, an inner conflict that's been resolved.
I was thinking, I've thought about this before, and kind of in lines of what we're talking about, this idea that, because I've had that exact same idea about multiple personality disorder, that it's just an extreme of what we all experience, and that ours is very context dependent usually, this kind of change in personality, whether it's social context or career context or whatever. Mm-hmm. And one of the things when you talked about that idea that we become more integrated before we actually discover that even that we actually become more of a self, or at least a whole self, mm-hmm. a continuous self, before we recognize that even that's still not anything substantial. But speaking of what Beatrice brought up about how meditation facilitates that integration, one of the ways I've thought about it is that with meditation, you develop this mindfulness that you carry throughout the day, throughout even into sleep sometimes, mm-hmm. and it almost becomes like a context you carry everywhere.
Yes,
so that right. you're no longer subject to these extremes, mm-hmm. because you've lost that context because it's always present. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, that's kind of how I think about it now and experience it. Like whether you talk about it as a context or an anchor, but some commonality that kind of threads through all of experience. And so, whereas before I could go to work, especially as a waiter, when I used to do that, it just turned into this personality I hated. I'd barely be aware of it. Because I'd come home and I'd slowly transition back into the me that I like a little bit more. But now, that's not something I can do anymore. Like, if I go into that, there's still some part of myself that doesn't warp based on context that sees that and is like, this isn't working anymore.
That's very good. That's wonderful. That's the kind of thing that's supposed to happen. And you mentioned the mindfulness even when you're asleep. That's one of the things. You know that this is really starting to happen to you when you start to experience that mindfulness even when you're asleep.
I really only get that on retreat though, most of the time.
Before. What's that?
I really only get that on retreat or for a little while afterwards. Mm-hmm.
But even a little while, it's wonderful. But then there's more that will come, more and more, and it's exactly what you want to happen. Yes, wonderful, very good. Yeah, the practice is. You can see the ways that the practice pays off. You see where it takes you to. So you see this idea of the separate self, the way we imagine we are. You know, this is the most important idea that you can understand, you as an individual in your entire life. And I think it's the most important idea for the world that can be understood. These other questions about what is the relationship between not just between those of us who are alive now and those who lived in the past and those who live in the future, but also the relationship between those of us who are alive at the same time and each other's present. There is much mystery, much wonder, much to be discovered there. But don't get into the trap of thinking of separate selfhood as any part of that. Even the idea of rebirth as a linear sequence, you know, that and in nature this doesn't happen either, because a perfect metaphor for the way that karmic imprints, karmic predispositions pass through time from one individual to another is the way our genetic material does. You're not your mother, and you're not your father, but genetically, you're some of both. And you're some of four different grandparents, and of eight different great-grandparents, and so on and so forth. And your genetic material not only combines with your mates, but each of your offspring gets a different selection from what is you. And why should it be any different in terms of the karmic transmissions? Right? Give me one good reason to think that it should be that you have to get only the karma from one person, and that's all, and they get the karma from only one person before them, and so on and so forth. Give me one good reason to believe it would be that way.
That's a wonderful analogy. Mm-hmm. That's a wonderful analogy.
Thank you.
Yeah, really.
It's very helpful.
Yeah. On the other hand, the more good karma that we make, the more beings will be born in the future who will enjoy the fruits of that good karma. The more bad karma we make, the more beings are going to be born in the future who suffer the consequences of that. And you don't need to consult a mystic to know the truth of that, right? When you do good in this world, that good will continue. And so it is. So anyway, what are some of the things about last week that you heard about?
About what?
You said there were things that people...
Oh, the dizziness? It was just a lot of wonderful information, but it was packed. And so I and some other people had problems to digest it. So
oh, they had indigestion. Okay. And I understand that. Forgive me. You know, I shouldn't give you such a rich meal and such a large quantity in such a short time.
No, it was a good meal.
It was a good meal.
Couldn't sleep afterwards.
Yeah. Oh, good. I'm glad. So has our discussion tonight helped to put this more in perspective? Yes. Yeah.
Are we out of time?
What's that?
Are we out of time?
We've got an eternity left, as far as I can.
I was just curious. I find myself a lot. I'd say a big theme. I'm really curious, actively curious about this experience of no self.
About this wish?
Experience of no self.
Experience of no self.
And I find my mind's overly eager to kind of seek that out in meditation.
Yeah.
And I actually get really excited when I think I'm close to something that is some indicator of that, and then the excitement overwhelms and I lose my stability and all that. But I'm wondering, I was thinking recently, it seems like I can hold in my mind this very clear sense of what I myself is, like the quality that I see is this like kind of static self identity, like the feeling of being a self, or a personality, not the feeling of being a separate person, but more the personality self. And I can hold that idea a little bit. And I'm wondering if there's a way to work with that where you can see through it. Where you can have that idea, I don't know how else to explain it, but like a quality that is like what I see as myself when I'm going through the day, my personality construct. Mm-hmm. Is there a way to work with that? Like just holding that there and maybe turning it so you can see from a different angle, or I don't know, just I've been wondering if there's a way to actively work with that. If that makes any sense, maybe it doesn't.
Well.
He's going to raise his question.
So, okay, you're asking how to work with the experience you have of being a self.
Right.
Okay.
Of being a personality self. Like you made the distinction, which I,
right.
I understand. Mm-hmm. Personality self and sense of being an individual.
Right. Yes, because there are on the one hand, there is at just a feeling level, a sense. It's the sense of being a separate self. And that's that feeling gets dressed up with all of the ideas and notions of who we are, the personality, you know. So you're talking about the awareness of the personality.
Exactly.
Construct.
Not the more subtle sense of just separation, but mm-hmm. just that like very kind of mundane, this is me, but it mm-hmm. feels kind of like at times it seems very vivid, like I see that this is how I see myself. Mm-hmm. And it's not even qualities, like particular attributes, it's just like this sense of my personality as a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, in terms of an introspective process is to examine the personality perception that you have and to be aware that it is a conceptual formation made up of other concepts and that they're not the same all the time. Just to be aware that the personality you think you are isn't the same always. To begin to regard it as another idea or collection of ideas that is absolutely no different than any other idea or collection of ideas. And the way that all ideas are the same is that all ideas arise in your mind due to causes and conditions. And we can speak of causes in two senses. There are those past factors which tend to make them inevitable, but the other kind of cause is they serve a purpose. You know? And so if you can see how the personality characteristics you identify with, what purpose are they serving in terms of your interactions with other people and your desires and goals and wishes and things like that. And you can see them more clearly as ideas that they are. So try that. I think that will be helpful there. I mean, basically, you're looking for that place of saying, and just understanding that the personality construct is a construct made up of a whole bunch of ideas. It's changing. It's changing due to past circumstances, and it's changing due to current needs. That, you know, current purposes and things like that. As you see that, it starts to become clearer and clearer that, yeah, this is just a fabrication. This is just something that my mind is making up. And there's things about it I don't like. Why didn't my mind make it up differently?
And I had said that it doesn't feel like it has attributes, and I realize that's not true. Mm-hmm. But what first way it presents now, just thinking about it, is this image. But mm-hmm. it definitely, when I look closer at it, it is kind of...
Yeah.
Another, yeah, it's a collection of...
It's made up of parts. The feeling of being a separate self is kind of irreducible.
Right.
It's not made up of other parts. It's just this feeling that is hard to get rid of. Except that when you become an arhat, you'll be free of it for good. But in the meantime, you can notice that feeling isn't always there. Sometimes it's there, sometimes it's not. It'll always be there when you look for it, though. As soon as you look for it, boom, there it is. But what you can notice, being mindful, is, aha, a lot of time when I'm not looking for it, it's not even there at all. The other thing that you can do, that this is a good thing for all of you to do, is to work with the sense of self and the way it determines your interactions with others. As a matter of fact, we could call this the "What Would Buddha Do?" exercise. Because what would I be like if I weren't imprisoned by this idea of being a separate self? So, in your interactions with other people, First of all, you can expand your sense of self. And you can say, okay, you know, and this is what's really good if you've got a partner. But, you know, even if you don't have a partner, there are other people around you close to. But what you do is you expand your idea of self to include another person to begin with or other people. And then you start noticing, okay, there's this idea in my mind of me, self, and other. Let me switch those. Okay, so now I'm going to think in terms of, I'm going to respond and think in terms of this person's needs, desires, discomforts, etc., as though they were mine, and mine as though they were the other person's. Okay? And begin to see what you can do with that. You know, what can you do to help meet the needs, relieve the pain, add to the pleasure and happiness of the other person without giving any priority to the self. And treat yourself like you would the other person. You know, it's like, okay, snap the candy bar in half, and this piece is a little bit bigger than that. Okay. So, if in the past, self would have said, okay, not my fault it broke that way, but I'm going to take the big guy. Yeah. There.
Well, you could get over, I would think you could get over, I'm right and you're wrong.
Get over, I'm right and you're wrong. That's
strong.
Right.
I think that's a very strong.
There are some formal practices that are all about doing this, and one of them is exchanging yourself for another, and it's a formal practice. There are a set of eight practices which are called eight practices for training the mind, and they're all about doing things like that. When there's a disagreement with somebody else, make yourself wrong and then right. Things like that. Whenever you are in a group of others, regard yourself as the least among those present. The least important. Everyone else is more important than you are. These are very powerful practices. They're very powerful because they undermine quite directly our attachment to our sense of self. Because what we're doing is we're transplanting that consciously, deliberately, which makes us very, very aware of it. You have to become so aware of your sense of self, you know, in order to do this. It just, you know, it just keeps staring you right in the face every time you make the swap.
Where does that come from?
These are specifically Tibetan Buddhist practices. And as a matter of fact, why not? I'll bring you a copy of the Eight Practices for Training the Mind. They are absolutely wonderful. They're shocking. I gave them to one person, and we had to discuss them quite a bit. And then he absolutely loved them and lived by them ever since. So,
before, when you said, you know, who are you?
Yeah.
I couldn't answer it. And I was thinking, boy, 6 months ago, I could have answered that in a heartbeat. You know, I had, you know, a whole list of things that, you know, who I am. And now I have no idea. You've helped so much.
And the what happens instead is that you start to see more clearly who you are right now. And it doesn't have to be this person that's going to still be there an hour from now or that was there yesterday or anything else like that. It's much more real. You're able to embrace the flux, which is the nature of suchness. And you are a part of this flux. So, as you, as a degree to which you can embrace that and become fully a part of that, then there's no more need to attach in the same way to the idea of self. It becomes much more fluid and flexible, and you can see how the things come and go. Your mind will still do the same things it's always done, and it's a good thing because it allows you to function in the world, things like that. But it's without the attachment to it. As I say, it becomes very fluid. Yes.
There's a saying that I read recently that was, stop siding with yourself.
Stop what?
Stop siding with yourself.
That's right. That's a good way to put it. Stop siding with yourself. So these are really powerful ways to deal with it. If we look at the precepts and the perfections. Everybody knows the precepts, right? Must be somebody that doesn't know the precepts. Everybody knows the precepts. Okay.
I'm not sure I do.
Okay. They are the basic five precepts is to don't destroy or harm or destroy other living beings. Don't take what's not freely given. Don't engage in sexual misconduct. Don't engage in wrong speech. And don't willfully engage in activities that cause dullness of mind. If we take the first four of these, they can all be summed up with practice harmlessness, cause no harm to others. If we add the fifth one and recognize that all the things that are covered by the first four also harm us, because they condition us in negative ways. Mm-hmm. You can sum up the precepts by saying, cause no harm to yourself or others.
But there are 10.
What's that?
There are 10 precepts, not 5.
Well, the 10 precepts they're going beyond these. These are the five that have to do with the practice of virtue by itself. Now, the other five precepts, the Upasika precepts, which we do on Upasita Day on Sundays, these are also addressing the practice of some of the other perfections. The perfections, you don't know what the perfections are, but I'll tell you, and eventually you'll know them. The first one is the perfection of generosity. The second is the perfection of virtue, which is identical with the precepts that we just discussed, right? But the perfection of generosity is covered in the second set of five precepts. And then there's the third perfection is the perfection of patience, and that is also addressed in the second set of precepts. We won't need to... It'll be enough right now to remember those three perfections, and the other three we can work on as we go along. Actually, you already are. The fifth perfection is meditation. So you're already working on that one. And the sixth perfection is a perfection of wisdom, which begins with learning the Dharma, which you're doing, reflecting on it, overcoming doubt, and then ultimately having the direct experience of these truths as well. So you're really doing all of the perfections already. You're also doing the fourth one, which is joyful right effort. So, yes. But anyway, I'm sidetracking myself here. And we still got eternity. Okay. If you look at the first five precepts, which are about not causing harm to others or to yourself. Now, why on earth would we ever do anything to cause harm to others anyway, or to ourselves?
Craving, attachment.
Craving, yes, desire and aversion, exactly. So, to practice these perfections and to keep these precepts, what we're doing is we're using a set of rules to help us behave as though we were already awakened, as though we were already Buddhas, yes. As though we had already overcome craving, as though the root of craving and the belief in a separate self had already been overcome. So that's what we're doing when we practice when we keep precepts and practice of perfections, is we're trying to behave as Buddha would. We're trying to do what Buddha would do. Now, of course, because we still have a self and we still have cravings and things like that, that means that in trying to practice these perfections and keep these precepts, we're going to keep coming up with problems like, what would the Buddha do? But this, but that. Well, what if this? What if that? Well, maybe, you know, right? But that's good, because that gives you an opportunity. What is the only reason that you don't immediately know what's the right thing to do is that you've got desire and aversion and attachment to self operating in your mind. So, if you're going to try to sort out the problem, you're probably going to discover the roots of the problem in desire and aversion and attachment to self. And so you bring mindfulness to bear on those. So, the practices that you can do in your daily life are keep the precepts, practice the perfections, practice exchanging yourself for another. And these will have a tremendous impact. They'll make your life much better. They'll make you happier. They'll remove a lot of the problems that you have right now. And to the degree that you succeed in overcoming craving and attachment to self, one of these days, this whole complex system that is your mind is going to make a shift to a new way of functioning. And all of a sudden, it'll be so much easier. Because your reference point will no longer be the self in the same way that it was before.
The more I practice, the happier I am and the more loving I feel. Does that relate to attachment?
Well, usually to be happier and to be more loving means that you're becoming less attached. You're becoming less attached to the idea of yourself and the needs of yourself, which manifests as being more loving and more giving. And because your mind's not going around with the idea of all these needs of myself that I've got to take care of, and I got what I wanted there, but I didn't get it there, you're happier, you're more contented, you're more relaxed. Now, you can become attached to this. You can become, I'm so great, I'm so loving.
Oh, jeez.
You can become attached to that. And you have to watch out for it. And if it happens, it's, you know, you don't need to go and beat yourself up. You just need to say, ah, I caught me at it. Yeah. Because we do get attached. When our practice brings a lot of happiness into our life, we can get attached to that happiness and think that it's always going to be that way. But until you've become a Buddha, your happiness is always going to be impermanent. Mm-hmm. You're going to have your ups and downs, right? And the degree to which you're attached to your happiness, that's the degree to which you're going to suffer when the causes of your happiness disappear for a while. Mm-hmm. So, don't get attached to your happiness. Attachment is what our minds do in defiance of the reality of impermanence.
In 12-step recovery, I've heard people say, If you're having a lot of trouble in your life, this too shall pass. And if mm-hmm. things are going really well in your life, this too shall pass.
This too shall pass. Yeah. That's right. Yes, that's the thing. Impermanence works both ways. It's really bad. Yeah, it's going to go away. But all that you hold near and dear is
going to go away too.
That's right. So, and that's, you know, as we progress on this path, what you develop is equanimity. And that is, if desire and aversion are the way we react to pleasure and pain now, equanimity will be the way we react to them in the future. And equanimity doesn't mean indifference or not feeling, but it means non-reactivity. So what it means is that when we experience pleasure, we experience pleasure. We don't attach to it. When we experience pain, we experience pain. We don't resist it. Most of our suffering comes from the resistance and the attachment. And that's what you find when you don't attach to pleasure, is that there's much more pleasure to experience if you're not attached to it. I mean, if you attach to it, even while you're enjoying whatever it is you're enjoying, you're also suffering the prospect of its loss. You're also suffering the desire to have it again, you know. And you cannot experience pleasure nearly as fully with that kind of stuff going on in your mind as you can if you're just completely open and you accept it with inner equanimity, with non-reactivity. And the pain that is present, the pain is what it is, nothing more or less. But most of the suffering that we ever experienced has been our mind's resistance. And when the mind ceases to resist, the pain is just another unpleasant sensation that comes and goes. It's going to pass away. And so equanimity takes the place of desire and aversion, of craving. Loving kindness and compassion take the place of attachment to self. And wisdom takes the place of the ignorant idea that we think we know who and what we are, and we think we know who and what this world is. And okay, I guess we don't have eternity. Some of you haven't eaten supper yet. Some of you have families you need to go home to.
Well, we have it, just not as individuals.
That's right. Somebody else ate supper for us, so we don't have to worry about it. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For another inspiring discussion. Oh, and I'll make the announcement now that I forgot to make on the break. On the long table in the front, there is a petition written up by Sayadaw Vivekananda, who is the abbot of the monastery in Lumbini, Nepal. And what's happening there is Lumbini is in danger of being destroyed, overrun, by industrial interests, building mills and factories and things like that. And in fact, there are laws against this, but nobody is enforcing them. And so these business interests are just bringing in their equipment, setting things up, producing pollution, and basically destroying what the United Nations has recognized as one of the world's most sacred places, the birthplace of the Buddha, Lumbini, Nepal. What is Lumbini, Nepal today was originally the birthplace of the Buddha. So Sayadaw Vivekananda has asked us if we would sign a petition, and it's out there on that table. So I'd appreciate it if you put your signatures on there, at least if you agree that the government of Nepal should enforce the laws that are intended to protect this sacred site. And then I'll mail it off to the whole list of officials that I have to mail it off to. So. Okay, thank you very much.